This is WMUK's West Southwest. I'm Gordon Evans. Coming up, a discussion of immigration reform with Michigan Immigrant Rights Center attorney Susan Reed. But first, Aaron Miller represents St. Joseph and part of Cass Counties, which make up the 59th State House District. The Republican was elected to his first term in November. Representative Aaron Miller, thank you for being here.
Thank you for having me again, Gordon.
So let's begin with the budget. You're on the Appropriations Committee, one of the committee assignments as a freshman lawmaker, which I think many freshmen covet, actually. Michigan, though, is facing a budget shortfall, and some people might have heard the report on our radio station of John Roberts, the budget director on the Michigan Public Television program Off the Record, saying he would like to look at some legislation, perhaps putting some limits on what, how much businesses can claim on tax credits. Would you be in favor of something like that?
Absolutely. You know, that's all about working out a deal. What we're really dealing with here, though, is contracts. And so, obviously, we need to go back to the dealing table with these big businesses. Most of it is probably the big three, the Chrysler, Ford, and GM auto companies. And so it takes going back to the table and discussing with them prospects. Hey, will, you know, for a little sweetener, will you take out tax credits in an equal increment every year? That will help the legislature and the House Fiscal Agency, the Senate Fiscal Agency, and obviously John Roberts, the budget director, with planning purposes every year. That way we know how much money is really going out of the coffers, because we're talking about, if we have a hole, we're talking about general fund money. And general fund money, I think it's important for the everyday citizen to realize that, yes, we do have a $53 billion budget. However, a great deal of that money is federal money that's given down mostly for Medicaid and for Department of Community Health and Department of Human Services, several other smaller departments.
There's some transportation matching funds.
Correct. There's some transportation. And then you mentioned it. A great deal of the state funding then is just to match to obtain the federal funding. And so when you get down to it, Chairman Al Pasholka of the Appropriations Committee has let this be known many, many times. This is a big baby of his to get this education out, is that really we're talking about $5 or $6 or $7 billion of general fund state money that we can really play with. And then obviously look at corrections. It's about $1.95 billion, almost $2 billion out of that $6 billion that needs to go to corrections. So it's really a small pot of money that we're dealing with. And so it's very important to know how much you're really spending on tax credits every year. That's why predictability is huge in this case. And that's why I think that the legislature and John Roberts would probably even be willing to sweeten the deal just a little bit to trade for some predictability here. So we'll see that in coming months.
How would you sweeten the deal?
I think in adding just small amounts to the tax credits, I think.
But stretching them out over a longer period of time.
No business here is going to look at their contract that they have that's very advantageous to them and say, yeah, sure, I'll stretch this out over a long period of time and give you predictability. What's in it for me is what I see them asking. Now, maybe I'm wrong. Maybe they will work with the state and help us out with our predictability. I would hope that's the case, but I just look at this as being a need for something in it for them. And so we'll see that in months to come.
A lot of lawmakers have been criticizing actually the use of business tax credits and saying that this was not sound economic policy by the state. And they say that this projected shortfall in the budget is evidence of that. But at the same time, other groups like the Michigan Manufacturers Association are saying, had there not been these credits for the auto companies in Michigan, we would not be where we're at economically right now. Going forward, what do you want to see done? Should tax credits be part of an economic strategy for the state?
I think we learned our lesson. It's important to look at a few things. Governor Snyder has taken pride in the fact that he doesn't lay blame. I'll lay a little bit of blame, but then I'll also defend her at the same time. It was the tax credits at the end of the Granholm administration. However, I'm quick to always point out that we were in a budget crisis. We were in an economy crisis, not just in the nation, but in Michigan, it was really compounded. And so I defend Granholm and the legislature at the time. It was all the Republicans too voting on this. We were in a financial strait that looked like there was no light at the end of the tunnel for us. And this was seen as a savior for the auto companies and then therefore for the whole economy of Michigan. And it was looked at as the only way out. So I defend that era's legislature and Governor Granholm with the point that, look, they were looking for anything to hold up Michigan's economy. Now, with that being said, I don't think it's sound, at least to say for the next 20 years, we're going to allow these businesses to cash in these credits because things change. And we have seen things change now. Now the economy is up, but here we have general fund budget problems because of these holes that were created five, six, and even back to the end of the Engler administration. That's when these mega tax credits were formed. So I point out that this was bipartisan. This was not just Governor Granholm's fault. But I think now we've learned our lesson, and we're going to be learning over the next 15 to 20 years. And so I think that we ought to stay away from just throwing out tax credits. Let's work with businesses to maybe implement programs for all business to promote business, just like Pure Michigan. We're not looking at picking winners and losers with Pure Michigan. We are promoting the tourism industry as a whole. And I think that's generally what the MEDC is doing now, as opposed to the mega tax credits of 2009 and previously. So we'll see that in months and years to come as well.
Of course, much of the attention in the state in terms of the political chattering class right now is focused on May 5th, when voters will decide whether or not the state sales tax is going to go up as part of a plan to boost road funding. Should state lawmakers begin working on some sort of a backup plan, given that the polling right now is not favorable for that sales tax increase on which the entire road funding package hinges?
Right. We're talking about a complete reliance on this May 5th ballot issue, and there should not be a complete reliance on it passing. That's like counting on something happening in the future and then it doesn't. We absolutely, on the appropriation side, the entire legislature really should be looking at Plan B in this case, because that's what voters expect. If the voters reject this measure, and like you say, things aren't looking favorable right now, and I realize things can change in the next couple of months, one thing to point out is that roads are not going to be looking good as we thaw from this additional terrible winter and go into spring. So maybe voters will change their minds. Who knows? But the important thing to realize is that voters want this done. They want the legislature to take care of it somehow. I think some voters were frustrated that the legislature just bounced it back to the people. The legislature should be responsible enough to say, hey, we're going to take care of this problem for our people here in the state of Michigan. So absolutely, we should be supporting a Plan B at this point. We should even be planning in this next year's budget for additional transportation funding. And then if it does happen to pass, too much funding is not a problem. You can always go back and do a supplemental and decrease that budget later. But why aren't we doing it now? That's a good question. And hopefully in the next coming months, with working with the governor's budget, we can look at taking care of this problem once and for all. The governor passed down his budget recommendation with the assumption that it will fail. However, given that, there is not a bump in transportation funding. So it's a back and forth issue. The House Fiscal Agency, the Senate Fiscal Agency, and the budget director aren't planning for this to pass, but we haven't increased funding at all. So in other words, I guess we are planning on it succeeding as an administration, and we should really be coming up with a backup plan.
I realize that this would be a pretty tight deadline to have anything in place by, say, May the 1st, but would it give voters a comparison that, in other words, if you do not vote for the sales tax increase, here is what you're likely looking at in terms of increased fees or other things that might be part of some sort of road funding deal?
Yeah, just to speak to that, it really is weighing the decision for the voters. Voters have to look at, if I'm spending $10,000 in goods, the math is simple. An additional 1% means another $100 in taxes, strictly on your sales tax. Obviously, that's on sales taxable goods. But you have to weigh the decision. Is it $100 of additional taxes every year? And granted, that's strewn out over many transactions over many months with your family and in your budget. You may not even see it, you say. Is that worth fixing our roads and all these things that are going through here. And obviously there are sweeteners in the deal. There's an additional $300 million for schools. There's additional money for revenue sharing for townships, cities, and villages. That's why townships, cities, and villages have signed on to this big time. Yeah, let's call it what it is. It's a sweetener. But that's how compromises get done. Voters are going to have to weigh the choices. And yes, they'll be able to take a look at, I've got this or this, and what do I want? Do I want to fix the roads? I'm in favor of looking at a hybrid plan. Do I stand against any tax increase? No, I don't. There are some who sign pledges for no new tax increases. I think that's short-sighted for what is, you know, what could possibly come down the road. But I'd be in favor of looking at a hybrid plan. Let's get some cost-saving measures in place first. Let's put some transparency into MDOT. That's one thing we're talking about on the Transportation Subcommittee right now. In the next coming weeks, we're hearing from MDOT about that. Let's get some things in place first that help keep MDOT accountable, that help save some money here, and then I'm in favor of a partial tax increase there. That's called a deal. What this is going through here, this is not really a deal. It's just a straight up tax increase. I oppose it, but mostly, for the most part, I'm just educating people about it from an objective standpoint. I'm getting information out to people. I'll just end with this question with saying that when you go to vote on May 5th, you're not just voting on a sales tax increase. Really, you're voting on 10 bills that were tie barred to this sales tax increase. And not a lot of people know that. There are some good things in these 10 bills. The complaint that is age old in Michigan is that our gas taxes don't go towards our roads. That is getting fixed. The sales tax is getting transferred from the gas tax to this new sales tax increase, and the gas tax is getting increased basically to refill that void. And this will make the gas tax go towards our roads. That's what people have wanted for a long time. That's a good thing. But there are other things like the school funding and the revenue sharing that I've mentioned that are in these 10 bills that honestly, voters have to look at all that before they go and vote. They're not just voting on a sales tax increase. And no, all of that $1.74-ish billion of new revenue does not entirely go towards roads. So it's all important things to realize. Part of the 10 bills is car registration fees are going up. So we're looking at a mixed approach here in this compromise. I'm not going to call the whole thing bad. There are good things in the compromise. Again, it's that voters have the choice now to, they have the responsibility rather to look at both sides and see what do I want? What's worth it?
But just to be clear, if somebody calls you up and says, Representative Miller, I don't know how to vote on this. What's your recommendation?
I say no. I'd like to come up with a better plan. Again, I'm not saying that to large groups in the district. I'm obviously not using state funding to argue no. This is like a candidate running for office. And as a representative, I can't go off and use my resources to oppose this. That's not what I'm doing.
But you're allowed to have an opinion on it.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah. If somebody calls me up and says, you know, what's your personal opinion about this? I'll let them know as I am on the radio show here.
Let me ask you about civil forfeiture. There's a report by the group, the Institute for Justice, which gives Michigan a D- in a report called Policing for Profit. And what they found is that Michigan's laws really do give law enforcement agencies an incentive to seize property because they get to keep it. And they recommend that Michigan should make some changes, and other states have in this area. Should Michigan be also be looking at civil forfeiture and perhaps making some big time reforms?
For sure. This is a no-brainer for me. This is something where also Democrats and Republicans can come together and unite on the issue. We're talking about our citizens. They may get stopped. They may be getting processed or getting questioned. And if there's not an arrest, if there is property seizure going on, that ought to change. And the conversation needs to really get going in Michigan. And I think it has. The Institute of Justice is really helping out with this. I'd like to work with my other representatives, one being Jeff Irwin, who has already spoken out about the issue. He's a Democrat from the Ann Arbor area. I'd like to work bipartisan across the aisle and look at getting this done to where our citizens have some protection. And like you said, the motivation now is that police agencies get to keep this property. that ought to change as well. Why are we talking about police agencies keeping this? It ought to come back, I think, even in the case of an arrest or a felony conviction, or if anybody is charged with a crime. Why is that property being taken away? If it's evidence, that's another story. Then it goes through the proper channels in the court case. But it's something I'd like to learn more about and something I'd like to pursue. I'd like to take a stand against property seizure, again, with my fellow representatives.
Representative Aaron Miller, thank you for your time.
Thank you, Gordon.
Republican Aaron Miller is the representative for Michigan's 59th State House District. That includes St. Joseph and part of Cass County.
This is WMUK's West Southwest. I'm Gordon Evans. Immigration is currently at the center of both legal and political battles. We're going to discuss immigration policy reform and what it means for immigrants in Michigan. Susan Reed is supervising attorney with the Michigan Immigrant Civil Rights Center in Kalamazoo. Susan Reed, thank you very much for being here.
Thank you, Gordon.
So we've got this ongoing court case. We've got a possible standoff in Congress, specifically over President Obama's executive order last year, which limits some deportations. So what does that create for the people who you serve at the Immigrant Rights Center in Kalamazoo?
You know, it certainly does create confusion. And I think one of the goals of the litigation was to create confusion. So, at the Michigan Immigrant Rights Center, we're a statewide advocacy program, and we do a lot of support for advocates around the state. So whether that's Latino community organizations, Arab American community organizations, other legal services programs, you know, we are supporting those programs and trying to do outreach to the community to help people understand the impact of this. But really the challenge of the injunction from the U.S. District Court in Brownsville, Texas, is that it does create uncertainty about the program. And the program already contains a lot of uncertainty for folks. You know, it's a temporary program. It provides work authorization and temporary relief from deportation, but because it's an executive action, it's really limited, and it is not a path to citizenship. There's no guarantee of future renewal. There's a significant fee. There are a lot of scam artists out there, you know, trying to say, oh, pay me now and I'll help you later. We ultimately don't know if this program is going to happen or not. I think we, as legal advocates, feel confident that this injunction won't stand. So we're confident it's going to go forward. But as your question suggests, it certainly creates confusion in what is already a tremendously confusing landscape, especially for the everyday people who this affects. You know, you have a lot of people with limited English proficiency who've had limited educational opportunity, who work 80 hours a week, you know, and so it is a challenge for us.
Let's go back for a moment to what you were saying about the program. Let's just say, for the sake of argument, the injunction's lifted, that whatever Congress is doing does not stop President Obama's executive action from moving ahead. As you said, this is not without some cost for someone who wishes to apply for the program. So, if this does move forward, what does it really mean for an immigrant in this country who is here undocumented or illegally and yet is looking to stay and work here, maybe not even look for citizenship?
Right. So the programs that President Obama announced in November are an expansion of the Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals program. And it's a small expansion. It just removes the upper limit on age. And that's a fairly small expansion of that program, which targets people who were brought to the U.S. before the age of 16 and who've had some educational attainment and a clean criminal record and who've been in the U.S. a significant period of time. The other program is for the parents of U.S. citizens and lawful permanent residents. I guess I want to kind of zoom out for listeners and make sure I say that those are really two groups of people that I think most of sort of the average bear who I talk to on the street thinks, well, don't you already have some way to get legal status if you have U.S. citizen kids, right? The myth of the anchor baby. I mean, that's an offensive term, but it's one that, you know, resonates with people. Or don't you already, if you've been here since you're, you know, really young, I mean, wouldn't there already be something? Or if you went to high school or went to college, couldn't you get a visa through employment or whatever the case may be? So I really want to put a fine point on the fact that even though those are groups that I think most people have pretty would think have pretty compelling equities for finding a way to stay here. That's not the case under current law. So the DACA program in 2012 was, you know, new to target those folks who've lived here in many cases since they were infants, but certainly, you know, since they were children. And then that other population of folks who have U.S. citizen children and may have a whole web of other U.S. citizen family members. So what's entailed, you know, we're expecting probably about a $500 application fee. And I think even most of the nonprofit organizations will be charging a few hundred dollars to prepare the application because the philanthropic resources so far, as we've kind of looked around for support to provide these services for people, just aren't there right now. So, you know, we'll be working on some pro bono coordinating, but people paying a private attorney may pay $500, $1,000, $2,000 to get assistance with this program. So there's a financial cost to application. And then the application, you know, should result in 3 years of work authorization and 3 years of reprieve from deportation. But after that, no one knows, right? So there's certainly no guarantee that the program will ever be renewed by a future administration. And there's no guarantee that folks who apply wouldn't be targeted for deportation. Because the way this program really works, what it really is, the authority that the president actually has is simply to say, among the 11 million people who are deportable, you can come forward and we'll put you on the bottom of the list. So what you're doing in these programs is you're signing up to be on the bottom of the list for deportation. But could the government decide, well, let's change our priorities. Let's take those people who signed up to be at the bottom and put them on the top. It could happen.
And then now, their names are more readily available.
Name, address, fingerprint, right? Photo, you know, known associates, where your kids go to school, where you've ever lived, you know, in your time in the U.S. So it's possible. Do I think that's likely? No, I don't. And am I counseling my clients after letting them know, you know, what the risks are, what the guarantees are? But, you know, we always say when we're practicing, we always say, you know, it's the client's decision, right? But I would say 9 times out of 10, the client looks at you after you say it's your decision and says, well, what would you do? You know, and I would apply, right? I would apply and I would encourage my own family members to apply. But it, again, it's not without some risk.
Hearing you say that, though, it's interesting because I recall interviewing candidates for Congress back in the summer and then the fall before the primary and the general election. And there seemed to be some general consensus that it was better to have people come out of the shadows in some way. That seemed to be a phrase that kept coming up over and over again with people who had varying ideas on how to do it and perhaps varying ideas of who should ultimately be able to apply for citizenship and should be able to stay is bring people out of the shadows. But just based on what I'm hearing you say there, this almost sounds like something which is going to have a limited effect of bringing people out of the shadows.
You know, for example, in Michigan, about half of the population that was estimated to be eligible for the DACA program went ahead and applied. So the program targeting young people who'd been here since they were children, it was estimated about 14,000 Michigan residents were eligible, and about 7,000 came forward and applied. You know, that program had its own unique political context and the timing. It was announced right before the 2012 election and the limits. So, you know, I think the administration wants the program to be successful, wants people to apply. I don't really know if you would deem it a success or failure that about half of people came forward. You know, I certainly wouldn't estimate that 100% of people who are eligible for this program will come forward. But when the families we talk to, you know, particularly the parents of young children, you know, that's somebody who's not just thinking about what it means if they get picked up at their job or picked up driving without a license. That's somebody who is thinking, and we have many documented instances of this, right? What happens if nobody picks my kids up at school? You know, CPS goes and gets them while I get deported and I may be separated from them for years or permanently. What happens when I get pulled over with my kids in the car and I'm going to get taken in because I'm driving without a license? So I would actually expect maybe a greater percentage of this newly eligible population to come through, because eligibility is based on that relationship to U.S. citizen and LPR children. And the families we work with and talk to are just so desperate for a greater sense of security around their family unity in this country.
Let's stipulate that the Michigan Immigrant Rights Center would just be one group out there that has an interest in immigration policy going forward. But
sure,
if Susan Reed and maybe some other people with your group had the opportunity to weigh in and write part of immigration policy, or at least have the chance to have some input on what a broad-based immigration reform would look like, what would that input be?
Sure. Well, just to keep it simple and not too wonkish, I would do something that looks a lot like the 1986 amnesty that President Reagan signed into law, that was really tremendously successful in integrating a large number of people into our workforce, into full participation in our communities. And it's so often identified as a failure because undocumented immigration continued after. You know, there was this false promise that came along with the 1986 Immigration Reform and Control Act that if you made it illegal to work without legal status in the U.S., which prior to 1986 it was not, that if you simply made it illegal to work and then legalized everyone who was here, you would take away all incentive for there to be undocumented immigration. And that belief, I think, was a totally misplaced belief that the reason people migrate is the pull factor, when in the decades that followed, we saw the reason people migrating was a push factor, you know, a push out of other economies, as well as a pull factor, because, of course, the verification system really wasn't as strong as the incentives in certain industries in particular to hire people who generally might be more exploitable and willing to work for a lower wage. But, you know, I think that program really had two significant components, you know, an initial registration followed by a period to allow deeper background checking and allow that, ensure that, you know, somebody wasn't, you know, involved in some kind of, you know, serious crime spree, and then a legalization program that was pretty clear and pretty simple and not full of pie in the sky requirements like, you know, become fluent in English even though you work 80 hours a week at, you know, in a meatpacking plant. It was a doable, attainable program for most people. It had its own flaws, but I think the trouble with the comprehensive immigration reform sort of bills that we've been able to agree on, and I understand what I want is very different from what's politically possible, right? But have sort of displeased everyone equally. Although ultimately, right, like Senate 744 in the last Congress, it passed the Senate. It would have passed the House if put to a vote. As you commented, Gordon Wright, from interviewing members of Congress, you do get everyone from Representative Amash to Representative Upton to our U.S. senators with, in many ways, relative consensus, right? Some significant disagreement
points, yeah,
around things like path to citizenship. But frankly, there's even significant disagreement in the movement about things like path to citizenship and whether it's been worth sort of giving up possible opportunities to get something that looked more like legalization without citizenship in order to sort of grab the brass ring of path to citizenship. You know, it certainly, in terms of what the president is proposing, something so temporary, something so limited in terms of, you know, ability to fully participate in the civic life of this country, there actually aren't very many people in Congress who would disagree that this is the first step.
Susan Reed, thank you very much for your time.
Thank you.
Susan Reed is supervising attorney with the Michigan Immigrant Rights Center in Kalamazoo. This is WMUK's West Southwest. I'm Gordon Evans.